I'm Marco Werman. Before we get to the show, we have some news. When you make a gift to PRI's The World Now, your contribution will be matched dollar for dollar. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift, and thanks for your support. Two different welcome mats today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. A group of migrants from Central America reaches Tijuana. Some decide to cross into California illegally, despite new U.S. rules designed to prevent that. One migrant appeared not to know anything about those rules.
He just sort of shrugged and said, well, we don't understand what's going on, and we're just hoping that whatever happens is supposed to happen.
Very different story for a young family from Eritrea, welcomed as refugees in Canada, where the kids just saw snow for the first time.
They came thundering up the stairs and ran out and closed their eyes, put their faces up to the sky and started twirling.
And singing and dancing. The video went viral. Those stories and much more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. They've come thousands of miles over the last month or so. Migrants from that first caravan we've been hearing about have started to arrive in Tijuana, Mexico. That's just across the southern U.S. border. We're talking hundreds of people here. Several thousand more migrants from Central America are still heading north through Mexico. Some of the migrants who made it to Tijuana were later seen climbing over the tall steel border fence and onto U.S. soil. The goal of many in this group of travelers is to seek asylum in the U.S. But a lot of them don't know about the new restrictions on asylum put in place by the Trump administration. Jean Guerrero is a reporter at KPBS in San Diego. She's in Tijuana, where she says things got tense last night between local residents and a group of migrants camped on a beach.
I spoke to some of the activists who were there last night who say that a mob of residents, about 40 or 50 people, came out and started telling people in the migrant caravan that they wanted them to leave, that they were not welcome in Tijuana, allegedly were using racial slurs against some members of the caravan. And some of the activists, about a dozen of the activists, linked arms to try and create a barricade because they wanted to let these families sleep and protect them from these residents who were angry about them being there. Mm. And they say that they were attacked, that they were kicked and punched. And I didn't see this with my own eyes, so I haven't verified this, but this is what they were telling me. And actually, while I was there, I actually saw many residents going up to members of the caravan and telling them that they weren't welcome, that they were worried that the caravan was going to create such an outrage from the U.S. government that it was going to hurt their own chances of being able to cross into the United States. So there's a lot of people in Tijuana.
Hurt the chances of these Mexicans who wanted to cross.
Yeah.
The US.
Hmm. Yeah, not illegally, but there's a lot of people in Tijuana who work in the U.S. or who cross the border for shopping and tourism purposes, because we're already seeing some lane closures at the port of entry in response to this caravan. There's a lot of people in Tijuana who are angry that the caravan is going to create a situation where it makes it harder for them to have their cross-border lives.
So at least these migrants had these activists who had their back, but I'm just wondering, how did they react to this aggression?
They told me that that a couple of the activists had no choice but to defend themselves. One guy who I spoke to told me that some of the activists themselves started throwing rocks, and so it became a violent sort of scuffle on both sides, but that the federal police officers who were there monitoring the situation didn't do anything to stop the aggression on either side. It appears that they had received instructions to not interfere because it could potentially escalate the situation.
So, Jean, where have you been today in Tijuana, and what have you seen?
So I'm at this sports facility. It's called La Unidad Deportiva Benito Juárez in this neighborhood of Tijuana called the Zona Norte. The city has basically, they're equipping this place to become an improvised shelter for the caravan migrants. The maximum capacity is about 2,000 people. There's basketball court, there's some outdoor areas, but so far they've only received about 250 people as of last night when they opened this area up. And actually, one of the reasons that there was a lot of anger from residents of Tijuana about the people who were sleeping on the beach is because they had heard about this facility being opened up by the government, and they were angry that a lot of migrants were choosing to stay out on the beach where they just didn't like the sight of them.
Yesterday, Jean, you watched two women and a child cross a fence somehow at the beach in Tijuana and then turn themselves into Border Patrol. You actually recorded part of the scene. So tell us what's going on here.
So I started recording after I noticed people gathering around the fence and screaming. As you see, they're just shouting out. They were encouraging these women who had just somehow crossed the border fence to keep going and to keep walking. And there's two women and a child who had somehow crossed the fence and were walking straight into a group of Border Patrol officers.
That's pretty brazen. Is that a violation of the new rules?
Yes. The husband of one of the women who crossed the fence yesterday was telling, I asked him, I was like, does she not know that the Trump administration has moved to no longer grant asylum to people who cross illegally? And he just sort of shrugged and said, well, we don't understand what's going on. And we're just hoping that regardless of what the president has said, that she'll be able to get asylum.
Hmm. Jean Guerrero is an investigative reporter at KPBS. She's also the author of Crux, a cross-border memoir. She's been speaking with us from Tijuana. Thank you very much, Jean.
Thank you. Great to be here.
People flee their home countries for different reasons, but the threat of violence is at the top of the list for many migrants. One group of people that's made their way to Tijuana to escape threats and discrimination are members of the LGBTQ community. Jonathan Ryan is with Raices, a migrant advocacy organization, and they're helping many LGBTQ migrants. He joins us from San Antonio.
We sent a team from Raices down to work with the caravan. And they came to meet this group of about 77 individuals who belong to the LGBTQ community, who found themselves in pretty tough conditions after having fled their country because of who they are. They continued to receive threats and assaults and were in danger even while on their journey through Mexico. So we decided that we were going to help them to get safely to Tijuana. And so that's why we helped them to get and paid for bus tickets for them to get ahead and get to Tijuana, where we were able to find them some safe accommodations and send lawyers down who could help them to prepare for presenting themselves to the border and requesting asylum.
And this particular community of people, LGBTQ, what were they facing in their home countries?
These are people who have already experienced rape, assault, attacks in their home countries just because of who they are. And so when they had the opportunity to flee, they did just that.
Can you just give us a one-person story, perhaps, and put a face to this group?
I think about one individual who expressed that after having spent years being assaulted and discriminated against and picked upon and marginalized, once she was able to cross over the border into Guatemala, she's a trans woman, and she took from her pocket a rainbow-colored flag, which she then spread and flew as she walked along. And to the individuals who saw this, they asked her, what country is that flag for? And with great pride and relief, she said, this is the flag of the entire world. And I think what's most moving amid all of the suffering and the harm that these people have fled and are continuing to experience, there is still great hope in these people for protection. And it's so important to remember that this is the spirit that people bring with them when they're seeking protection here in the United States. It's no different than the immigrants and refugees that we have seen coming to our shores for hundreds of years.
We just heard from reporter Jean Guerrero in Tijuana that there have been tensions between migrants and local residents. What are you hearing from your people on the border?
This is a part of the border where people traditionally pass through relatively quickly as they request asylum or entry at the border and move along. It's not surprising. In fact, it's probably the intended consequence of the administration's sealing up and blockading the border, that they will cause tension in the local community as immigrants of all kinds and refugees languish at the border waiting for their place in line. The only way to ease these tensions and resolve this is for the United States to live up to its commitments and its obligations under domestic and international law and humanely and efficiently process these asylum applicants.
I know a lot of people would like to believe that what you just said will happen, but something has shifted in the U.S., and there are a lot of people who support Trump's policies on immigration.
I don't know that it's true that a majority or even a plurality of Americans do not think that our country should accept refugees. When people hear the individual stories, when they are exposed to the truth, they see that this is necessary and beneficial.
Jonathan Ryan is the executive director of RAISIS, a nonprofit immigrant legal service group that's assisting migrants at the border in Tijuana. Jonathan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Shh. It's quiet today in South Korea, and that is intentional. All across that country, more than 500,000 students are taking the National College Entrance Exam. It's a marathon of back-to-back tests that takes about 8 hours to get through. It doesn't just dictate where students might go to college. The test could have an impact on job prospects and income for years to come. It's called the Sunung. It is such a big deal that all of South Korea cooperates to make it a silent day. We reached out to Janet G. Young Lee to hear more. She grew up in South Korea. Janet is now a PhD candidate at the University of Washington in Seattle.
Silent day is figurative. Everybody is very mindful of the stress and the pressure that these students are under. And, you know, every citizen in Seoul, even if it's a taxi driver or someone who's doing an advertisement on the street, they're trying to be mindful that a little noise can really bother them. And so they're trying to make an environment where the students can perform the best.
And is that environment obligatory, or does everybody kind of just understand the students are under stress and the banks close and businesses open late?
It is not obligatory. It's more of citizens trying to care for the students because they've also been through that kind of pressure when they were in high school. So I wouldn't say it's obligatory, but it's a nice gesture that everybody participates.
So you're getting your PhD here in the States, but you went to elementary and middle school in South Korea. Were you starting to feel the pressure to prep for the Sunung at that age?
Korean, English, and math is a common subject that everybody has to take. And my parents were trying to prepare as much as possible on English during my elementary school year. So I had intensive private academy after school, and I listened to cassette tapes so that I could practice on my own. And then somebody called me every day to make sure I did the work. It's almost like doing double work. Last time I checked, South Korea adolescent suicide rate is the highest in the countries. And it's a shame. And I think the pressure on academics that early on has a lot to do with it.
Wow.
My aunt had three children and they all went through the Sunung. And I remember her talking about how stressful it is for her to care for the children because, you know, they're always on the edge and always very stressed. And that creates added pressure for the parents.
What is the mood like on exam day itself? Because I've heard that despite the pressure, it's actually kind of joyous and celebratory.
Yeah, I mean, it is. I remember my friends getting these rice cakes for good luck because rice cake was very sticky. And the students who are taking the exam will receive these rice cakes from friends and teachers and also family members so that they could stick on the college entrance gate like rice cake sticks to stuff. So that's good luck. And then, you know, when they finish exams around like 5 p.m. and everybody comes out. I mean, some people cry because they don't think they did well. But I mean, most of the people are like really relieved that it's done. And now they feel like, oh, their life is just starting. They get to enjoy a little bit of the freedom that they have.
Janet G. Young Lee, PhD student at the University of Washington, Seattle. Thanks very much for telling us about the Sunung and Silent Day in South Korea.
Thank you.
Go to omahasteaks.com and enter the code WORLD into the search bar to get 74% off Omaha Steaks Family Gift Package, now only $49.99. Order now and you'll get 4 hand-cut aged-to-tenderness top sirloin steaks, 2 savory premium pork chops, 4 chicken fried steaks, 4 Omaha Steaks burgers, 4 snappy kielbasa sausages, all beef meatballs, 4 perfectly browned potatoes au gratin, 4 made-from-scratch caramel caramel apple tartlets, plus get 4 more burgers for free. Again, just go to omahasteaks.com, type WORLD into the search bar, and add the family gift package to your cart. Don't wait. Order today.
I'm Marco Werman, here with the world. 101 and counting. That's how many women just won seats in the U.S. House. And over in the Senate, Arizona Democrat Kyrsten Sinema clinched her election this week. Bottom line, a record number of women will go to Capitol Hill in January. But let's be real, women will still make up less than a quarter of the new Congress. The world's Allison Herrera looks at how other countries boost women's participation in government.
Let's back up a few years. When a reporter asked the new Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau,
I understand one of the priorities for you was to have a cabinet that was gender balanced. Why was that so important to you?
Because it's 2015.
It's 2018, and most countries, including the U.S., still don't have equal representation in government, whether elected or appointed. Some do, like Cuba and Sweden. Some of that has to do with making gender representation a priority. But in other cases, it's about setting quotas for women in government. Currently, 24 countries have some form of gender quotas. Catalina Uribe-Bircher of the Institute for Electoral Assistance in Stockholm says quotas can produce a ripple effect.
When women manage in some countries to gain those positions of power in decision-making, it not only affects the political landscape in a country, but the whole perception of women in general in all other fields of life.
Uribe's group tracks women's participation in politics. She says, yes, the election of a record number of women to the U.S. Congress is great, but other countries are still way ahead.
In comparison to the position of women in politics in Bolivia, in Rwanda, in Ethiopia, which are probably not the expected examples, they are more the unusual suspects, but they have done so much in terms of participation of women in politics, not least because of quotas.
In 2003, Rwanda adopted a quota system, reserving 30% of seats in government for women. Today, women make up 61% of the parliament there. So are quotas the answer to increasing women's influence in government? Not so fast. Some say that quota systems depend on who holds the power in the first place.
Bringing women in the institutions and leadership does not mean automatically that they have power.
That's Rosebel Kagumire, a feminist blogger and journalist in Kampala. Uganda has had a gender quota for more than 20 years, and she says it still hasn't made that much of a difference in women's lives, especially when it comes to enacting laws that affect women.
Despite an increased number of women in the parliament, you see still a lot of legislations that are targeting women.
Kagumire mentions a bill that would increase the penalty for sexual assault. She says it's something that would protect women in Uganda, but it's been stalled for decades, even with more women in parliament.
We have not seen women being vocal to bring this law to actually pass.
So quotas for women in government don't always translate into more power and gains for women. For instance, Saudi Arabia has 20% quota for women in its legislature, which, by the way, is higher than the percentage of women in Congress right now. But Saudi women only got permission to drive this year. Still, Erin Velarde of the group Run Vote Lead says the U.S. should think about gender quotas, even though she knows it's unlikely.
It's what you need to do to get to the norm of women running at every level.
Run Vote Lead helps women run for office. They show them how to fundraise and run a successful campaign. Ilhan Omar, who just won the election in Minnesota, is one of their graduates. Velarde doesn't like the term quotas. She says it's patronizing. But she thinks it's critical for government to be more representative of those they serve. And if that means quotas,
it's a way to accelerate and normalize women in public office. Because if you just wait for the old systems to actually, you know, all of a sudden open up and welcome women and give them the resources they need, that's not going to happen.
One thing is clear after last week's elections. A new crop of women is entering politics here in the U.S., and they're not waiting for someone to hold a seat for them. For The World, I'm Allison Herrera.
You don't need to know much about ballet to know that the shoes are key. For ballerinas, those hard-toed slippers make it possible to stand up on the very tips of their toes, with their legs looking like one long uninterrupted line. Part of the trick here is getting a pointe shoe, as the ballet slippers are called, that is the same color as your leg. That can be a problem for ballerinas of color. There's a new collaboration, though, aimed at fixing that. Ballet Black is a dance company in London featuring dancers of color. Freed of London is a shoe manufacturer. They teamed up because of Kira Robinson. She's a sole American dancer in Ballet Black. So before this collaboration, when you got a new pair of pointe shoes, what did you have to do?
I had to use makeup foundation and a sponge and just kind of coat the pink shoe with a shade of brown that matched my color best, just to, you know, make it not so dull. Mm. But yeah, about 45 minutes, including the ribbons, which are pink, and the elastic as well.
Wow. And makeup's expensive, and you just don't want to be rubbing it all over a pair of pointe shoes.
Well, after a while, it adds up, but it's, you know, the only way.
Yeah. I'd love to know, like, doing all this and not being able to find different colored pointe shoes, how much did that inhibit you from actually wanting to dance?
It didn't inhibit me at all, actually, because pancaking was common. I started out, as most people did, in pink tights and pink shoes. And for a lot of places, that's the uniform. It's required, you know. So it was nothing odd, or I didn't feel any sort of way about it until at 15 I went to the Dance Theater of Harlem, and having the flesh tone tights and shoes were required. So that was a whole new world for me, which kind of opened my eyes to the difference between the pink tights and the, you know, flesh tone.
Right. So now there are new shoes. When did you find out about that?
A year and a half ago. Yeah. I had gone into Freed because at this point I was just a bit tired of pancaking. I saw, you know, pink shoes, purple shoes, red shoes, and I just inquired about making a brown shoe. My company, Ballet Black, got involved, and slowly but surely they found the right fabrics, and it started from there.
So what was it like when you actually got a pair of these pointe shoes and, you know, put them on?
It's a bit indescribable, only because I never thought it would happen. And at that particular time, it was kind of a special order for me. And I just thought all of the hours that I would save from pancaking, but also, like, immediately I just saw change. You know, it just took a matter of following through with an idea.
And when you're dancing, does it change how you dance in any way?
If anything, it'd be more stable. I'd have to do less to my shoe. I think with the foundation, you know, it being liquid, it already breaks the shoe down a bit. They would deteriorate, I guess, a bit quicker. And so I'd be worried about, you know, the next shoe that I'd have to do already when I'm wearing the current shoe that I'd be wearing.
Just because of this one piece of equipment, these shoes, do you feel more acknowledged in the ballet world?
For me, it's not about acknowledgement. I think because I have been wearing the prototype for a year, so I've been used to it. I just feel like it's mine, you know, it's special to me. And I know any other dancer who wears Freed who buys that shoe, it'll just, you know, it's personal. It's your shoe.
Ballerina and senior artist at Ballet Black in London, Kira Robinson. Great to meet you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you so much.
Before we get back to the show, we have some exciting news. PRI's The World is participating in Newsmatch, a campaign to raise money for high-quality, independent journalism. When you make a gift to The World now, your gift will be matched dollar for dollar. Listener donations help fund our staff of reporters and producers, international reporting assignments, and the equipment here in our studio that makes this show happen every day. Visit theworld.org/match to make your gift. And thanks very much for your support. I'm Marco Werman. The war in Yemen started almost 4 years ago. That is a very long time for this man's children.
My two kids witnessed my incarceration and my torture. So they do know what's going on around them. They grew up really fast.
They've left Yemen now, but the war goes on. That story still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I cannot believe they're predicting snow here today in our city. That is a middle-aged man complaint. So spare a thought for kids enjoying snow for the very first time. A girl and her younger brother run into a backyard in winter coats. They jump up and down, twirl, and hold out their hands to catch the falling snowflakes. Joyful. I might even enjoy snow again myself. The look on these kids' faces is priceless. The video was shot by Rebecca Davies. She's with the Ripple Refugee Project based in Toronto. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi there. How are you doing?
I'm all right. Tell us who these children are and what their story is.
These two cuties are, I've been here exactly a week today. Last Thursday, November 8th, we picked them up at the Toronto International Airport, where they had come on a long, long journey from a refugee camp in Sudan, where they'd been living for 5 years, after having fled the war in their home country, Eritrea, in 2013. And so we picked them up last week, we being their sponsor group, the Ripple Refugee Project. And it was a nice day last Thursday. It was quite temperate, sunny, nothing remarkable. Friday was drizzling, rainy, very cold. We didn't do much. They slept. We didn't go outside, certainly. But Saturday morning in Toronto, it was a crisp day, and the kind that you know could be the first snowfall. And I was puttering around making coffee, something, and there it was, those big, fat, fluffy first of the season snowflakes that might just be a tease and not stick to the ground. And we hadn't really built up a relationship yet, but my instinct was just to scream, "Hey, everybody, get up here." And everybody got up there. And there's four kids in this family. They're staying with us for 6 weeks. We move into their apartment.
So that was your backyard in the
video. That's my backyard. Yeah. My everybody knows what it looks like now. Glad I've done some weeding. And, you know, the four kids and mom were just enthralled, right at the door. And then the two older ones kind of disappeared. And I must admit to a moment of disappointment, because I thought, oh, wow. I thought the two eldest ones, 7 and 5, would find this the most enchanting of all. And so that's fine. We the rest of us enjoyed it. And then 2 seconds later, they came thundering up the stairs in ill-fitting winter clothing that we'd just sort of collected, not even sized them for yet, opened up what I consider a 1,000-pound sliding patio door themselves and ran out and closed their eyes, put their faces up to the sky and started twirling and singing and dancing. Wow. And you see the rest. Yeah.
How long did they stay out in the snow for?
They were out as long as the snow lasted, which was about, I'd say, about an hour and a bit. And they went through all the rituals and rites of passage, and they ate it, they licked it, they chased it. We made mini snowballs.
They do snow angels?
It wasn't enough of accumulation, yeah. But in Boston and Toronto, we're expecting quite a big snowfall today, and I can feel it already in my bones coming, and so we'll be up there making snow angels for sure today, yeah.
And how long are they going to be staying with you?
They'll stay with us for 6 weeks. We've rented an apartment, and the family will move into their own apartment on December 15th.
Now, your Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, sent out a tweet saying, "Amazing. Now convince them that shoveling is fun and you're all set." I'm glad to see I'm not the only one who sees the downsides of snow. Trudeau did also thank you, Rebecca. Tell us what your organization, the Ripple Refugee Project, does.
Yeah, I take that thanks as one to not only the Ripple Refugee Project, but to the hundreds of other sponsor groups around the country, which are comprised of private citizens, you, me, you need a group of five friends, literally, or a group of five people with the common interest of sponsoring. So you raise a bit of money, you apply to the government, and you get matched with a family. And then the hard work begins, the integration and the settlement part. So absolutely, I take that thanks as thanks to the Canadians who are in any way involved in refugee sponsorship and resettlement, whether you've made a donation or whether you're hands-on like we are. And I also would thank the Canadian government right back for having this program that we're able to take advantage of and advocate for that other countries implement as well.
Mm. How many refugees has Canada taken in this year? Do you know?
The stats are somewhere. It's in the tens of thousands. And it could be more, though.
You thank the Canadian government, which I would say a couple of decades ago or even 5 years ago probably wouldn't need to thank a government for doing this. But these days, refugee admissions, it's not a given, is it, in some places?
Absolutely not. And the narrative is so obvious and looming just south of the border where you are, where the story is that troops are amassing at the border to keep people out. And, you know, it is not universal here in Canada. I will not paint that picture because there's always work to do. There's always minds to change and there's always vigilance to keep on these precious policies and open borders. So we're not naive either. But when you see a magical moment of humanity and universality, and if it's a lovely little scene of kids in a snow, and that's what human beings' response is to the magic of the world before the politics, before the power, before the all the other things that can make somebody cynical or jaded. That's what I wanted to show to the world.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. I mean, what kind of impact are you seeing from this magical moment?
Don't forget, this is a passion project. This is a, it is also completely unpaid. We do it in our spare time. We all have full-time jobs and most of us have families and children and other passion projects. So the impact, we're just trying to keep our focus on what we're doing right now, which is settling this family. It's a big family. It's a vulnerable family. It's a single mom with four tiny kids. And I really hope that this sentiment continues beyond the 12, 48 hours, you know, flash in a pan viral moment.
Rebecca Davies with the Ripple Refugee Project in Toronto. Thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
A few minutes now to update you on the war in Yemen from a U.S. congressman and from this man.
My two kids witnessed my incarceration and my torture. My son came several times on Facebook and he read all the articles about my incarceration and about my torture. And I ended up having to take his phone away.
That's Yemeni activist Hisham Al-Omaisi. More from Hisham in a moment. First, though, the view of the Yemen war from Capitol Hill. Some members of Congress want to stop it. They're calling for an end to U.S. military support for Saudi Arabia, which is leading the intervention in Yemen. On October 30th, it looked like there was about to be a breakthrough.
30 days from now, we want to see everybody around a peace table.
That's U.S. Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis, calling for UN peace talks by the end of November. That's just 2 weeks away. It doesn't look like those talks are going to happen anytime soon. Jim McGovern is a Massachusetts Democrat. He says Democrats in Congress wrote a resolution that would have put a spotlight on the Yemen war.
Actually, it was a privileged resolution under the terms of the War Powers Resolution that would have allowed the House of Representatives to debate and vote on ending the unconstitutional, in my opinion, participation of U.S. forces engaged in the hostilities that the Saudi government is perpetrating on the people of Yemen. And, you know, we should have had that vote. The Republicans yesterday, in an unprecedented step, basically denied us that vote in a rule. And it's really disappointing that, given the fact that Yemen has turned out to be one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world, you know, there are countless people every day who are losing their lives because of this war. You know, and as I said, I mean, with the threat of starvation and other catastrophes looming, I mean, we need to make it clear to the Saudis that enough is enough.
Well, we've heard over the past 2 weeks that the Saudis have agreed to let some Houthi soldiers leave Yemen for treatment, medical treatment. We've heard about a possible prisoner swap. The Saudis have also asked the U.S. to stop refueling their jets. And we're hearing also the invasion of the port of Hodeidah has been put on hold for a day. How good is all this news?
You know what? It's not good news because I don't believe the Saudis have any intention of stopping this war. I don't believe they have any intention of stopping the killing. I think what they're doing is they're waiting us out. I mean, they're giving this administration a little some little crumbs to be able to say, oh, things are moving in a different direction. You know, this war has been going on for a long time, and the killing and the human rights atrocities just get worse and worse and worse and worse.
We heard Secretary of Defense Mattis earlier saying, we want everybody around a peace table in 30 days. Do you have the ear of the Secretary of Defense, and what do you tell him?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, we've told him, and we've told our Secretary of State, and we've made it clear to the White House that more needs to be done. And, the idea of the kind of, you know, saying, well, in 30 days, you know, we should have everybody around a peace table. I don't think that's going to happen. We want this to stop today, and there's no reason why it can't stop today. And again, the brutality of this war is so horrific. I mean, it should weigh in the conscience of everybody on this planet and raise people's voices to demand that this come to an end. And in the United States House of Representatives, one of the things we wanted to do yesterday was we wanted to have this debate, and we wanted to go on record as basically saying we don't want the United States to be complicit in any of this. We want to stop the sale of arms to the Saudi government. We want to stop any intelligence sharing or any role we play that might in any way, shape, or form aid them in their attacks on Yemen. That to me, was a timely debate. We should have had it.
Congressman, thank you very much for your time today.
All right. All the best.
That was Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts. Hisham Al-Omaisi spent the first 3.5 years of the Yemen war in the capital Sana'a. That's his home, where he lives. Last year, he was detained by Houthi rebels who control the city. He was not allowed to see his family. He was questioned and tortured. Hisham has since been released, but he's been keeping a low profile. We reached him on the phone from Cairo and asked him what's been going on in the 2 weeks since Secretary Mattis called for a ceasefire in Yemen. He began by telling us about conditions in the Red Sea port of Hodeidah, where the fighting has been intense up until yesterday.
Well, it's depressing, to be honest with you. The situation continued to deteriorate, and with the offensive in Hodeidah, there are almost 600,000 people in the city. There's no clean water. There's no electricity. You have people caught between the Saudi-led coalition and the Yemeni forces on one side and the Houthis on the other side. And these are street battles. And you have these civilians caught in the middle. And when I contacted my friends in Hodeidah, I'm like, just get out of Hodeidah. And they're like, we can't. The streets are riddled with landmines. We'll get caught in the crossfire. And even if we manage to get out, we can't reach another governorate because we don't have enough money to get to the other governorate. And if we get to the other governorate, we don't have money for rent and for food. So you get the picture. It's really grim.
Yeah, so when you hear Americans talking about the war in Yemen, Congress trying to do something but failing, what goes through your mind?
To be honest with you, there's a lot of political jousting when it comes to Yemen. I mean, I'll be blunt here. Congress, U.S. Congress, in the U.K., even in the EU, these are political maneuvers that has to do a lot with their domestic politics more than it has to do with Yemen. So we don't expect much.
So where do you find hope right now?
Well, hope is with Yemenis themselves agreeing to some sort of a peace deal. Unfortunately, we relied a lot on the UN to broker such a deal, and the UN did not outline a blueprint. Without a clear blueprint, there's no hope for peace.
I mean, it just sounds like there's no end in sight.
Unfortunately, no. A lot of people think that even if tomorrow they announce a peace deal, the war between the Houthis and the Saudi-led coalition would stop, but the internal war between the various factions will take years and years. They'll continue fighting for power internally.
You left Yemen with your children. How do you explain to them what's going on in their country?
Well, my two kids witnessed my incarceration and my torture. My son came several times on Facebook and he read all the articles about my incarceration and about my torture. And I ended up having to take his phone away. So he read and he saw it, and he actually one day he posted on Facebook saying, please, appealing to the Houthis, please release my dad. So he knows. He's old enough now, although he's only 12. They grew up really fast.
There was a tweet you put out not so long ago, basically saying it didn't really matter who wins this war at this point. Can you just elaborate what you were saying?
Well, the thing is that during my time in Cairo, I get to meet a lot of diplomats. And one of the things I kept being asked was that, who do you think will win the war, the Saudi-led coalition or the Houthis? People seem to miss the point that it no longer matters if the Saudis win or the Houthis win. The Yemeni people have already lost the war. You're talking about almost 80% of the population needing aid. The infrastructure has been devastated. It will take us at least 2 decades to rebuild what has been destroyed. I mean, we already paid the price of war in full, and future generations will continue to pay that price. So to the Yemeni people, to the average Yemeni citizen, he already lost the war. He already paid a heavy price.
Hisham Alomeisa, we're going to leave it there. It is really good to hear your voice again, and thanks for speaking with us about Yemen. You take good care.
Thank you, Marco.
On British Twitter today, Brexit chaos and Brexit shambles are trending hashtags. That shows you how lots of people feel about their government's progress on Brexit. 2.5 years after voting to leave the European Union, British Prime Minister Theresa May presented a plan. Her cabinet approved it last night, but within hours, a wave of officials resigned in protest. As for Prime Minister Theresa May, she's not backing down.
This is a Brexit that delivers on the priorities of the British people.
May dismissed the idea of holding a second referendum, and she said that Britain will be leaving the European Union in March next year.
Leadership is about making the right decisions, not taking the easy decisions. As Prime Minister, my job is to get the best deal for Britain and to bring that deal back to the House of Commons. And that's exactly what I am focused on doing. I think members of the public want the government to get on with delivering on Brexit for them. And as I said earlier, am I going to see this through? Yes.
People all over the globe are wondering what Brexit will mean when it's actually done, and they're weighing in on it. Among them, Steve Bannon, the former advisor to President Trump. He's been invited to speak tomorrow at the prestigious Oxford Union. Bannon is a hard Brexit guy, meaning he thinks Britain should sever all ties with the European Union. Bronwyn Maddox directs the Institute for Government, an independent think tank in Britain. I asked her what it means that Bannon is speaking in Britain at this very sensitive moment.
In a way, absolutely nothing. The Oxford Union is a fantastic piece of theatre. It's the debating society of Oxford University. It's done very formally. People turn up in evening dress. There's some on one side, some on the other side. And it attracts attention, but it is theatre.
Yeah, well, Bannon has maintained ties, though, with many leading hard Brexit conservatives in the British government, like the Nationalist UKIP Party, people like Nigel Farage. The heat of the Bannon spotlight, is this going to make things more difficult for Prime Minister May?
I'm trying not to pause for a long time after that, because the phrase the heat of the Bannon spotlight would get, I think, quite a lot of laughter over here.
Really?
He's a high color figure. He's one of the figures in American political life that people do know here. But the heat of the spotlight is very much on Parliament, on the members of the cabinet, on the MPs. And I don't think Steve Bannon rocking up in Oxford is going to really play into the debate.
Let me put the question this way. How does Bannon speaking at the Oxford Union and this struggle to get a Brexit deal through Parliament capture the zeitgeist in Britain right now?
Bannon in the Oxford Union and what is going on in Parliament both come from the same source, in a sense, which is the anxieties, the worries, the angers that led to the Brexit vote. And that, in a way, is captured by some of the things Steve Bannon stands for and has called for, a very nationalistic, sort of independent view of national interest. And it is very clear that Brexit came out of a lot of feelings among a lot of British people, fears about immigration, fears about being left behind in globalization, being on the wrong side of that, anger about the elites not speaking for lots of other people. People used it, as they often do, referendums, to articulate a lot of their frustrations. And part of the difficulty of Brexit has been that people didn't vote for any one version of Brexit. They were using it to express things. So Bannon and Brexit are part of the same zeitgeist, but they are going to play out in very different ways.
What are your personal feelings, Bronwyn, about where Britain is at?
I think Britain is at the beginning of probably a decade of quite painful debate among British people, absolutely among the members of Parliament, about what its relations with Europe are going to be. You've got two immediate options. This deal that Theresa May has brought back from Europe gets through Parliament, or it doesn't. But either way, I think we are really on for a decade of trying to thrash out what that relationship is going to be. If Brexit does happen, Britain will be moving away from Europe during that time. Europe itself is going to change. Europe itself is being pulled about by nationalistic, populist forces, a lot of concern about migration, a lot of internal concerns about the Italian budget and whether Europe can enforce its rules on its members. And we have, with Angela Merkel stepping down, you have the end of someone who really stood for that post-war generation. The generation who said, the point of the European project is never again the Second World War. This is about holding together these European countries, saying that we stand for common values, we stand for ever closer union. And with her stepping back, you open the door to a kind of shriller, more nationalistic, more populist set of leaders, less identifying themselves in that post-war project and much more in the interests of their own countries.
So 10 years, you believe, to work out totally the UK's relationship with Europe. I mean, in that time, couldn't Europe splinter further?
I think the EU has handled this in a way that has probably successfully discouraged other members from trying to leave. It looks really, really painful. It doesn't make it look an attractive proposition in the way that it did immediately after the referendum. And the EU has clearly gone out of its way to discourage other members from thinking, oh, we'll go out and have the best of the EU from the outside. Europe itself may change a lot in the next 10 years. You've got countries really explicitly challenging the rules that hold the European Union together, both on values and on finances. And you could get really quite a lot of change. If the European Union really wants to hold itself together, it may have to flex a bit to accommodate those things.
Bronwyn Maddox is director of the Institute for Government, an independent think tank in Britain. She's also a visiting professor at the Policy Institute at King's College, London. Thank you very much.
My great pleasure. Thank you.
We don't like saying goodbye to our colleagues here at The World. It's especially hard when it's somebody you've worked with, side by side, since forever. That's what it feels like anyway. Andrew Sussman and I were part of the crew that started making this program in 1995. There are still a handful of us in the newsroom from that first team. Andrew had a marathon stint as show producer and then took over as EP, executive producer, in 2012. Now, those titles probably don't mean much. Let me put it this way. Anytime you hear this show, you hear Andrew. The way we tell stories, the way we see the world, that's Andrew. As our fearless leader, he enabled all of this. Andrew, you may be moving on, but that legacy is rock solid, my friend. Now, you don't know this, but Andrew speaks Russian and French, and when we first met, I gave him the nickname Serge, as in Serge Gainsbourg, the French crooner. So, Andrew, all the best to you. After several thousand spins of the world, this one's for you.
Écoute ma voix, écoute ma prière. Écoute mon cœur qui bat, laisse-toi faire. Je t'en prie, ne sois pas farouche. Quand me vient l'eau à la bouche, je te veux confiante, je te sens captive. Je te veux docile, je te sens craintive. Je t'en prie, ne sois pas farouche. Quand me vient l'eau.
Now for the business end of things, the world comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. And for one last time, our executive producer is Andrew Sussman. I got nothing else except thank you for everything.
Laisse-toi au gré du courant, porté dans le lit du torrent, et dans le mien, si tu veux bien.
PRI, Public Radio International.